And welcome to the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm Phil Taylor. And today we're going to be talking to Thomas Martin Sobotky. He is the author of Across That Dark River. I'm going to call it a meditation on the American Civil War and the continuing issue of race in America. And he has a lot of thought, a lot to say on that subject. The headlines of the murder of young Trayvon Martin, headlines from Tulsa, all very disturbing. And apropos, we are also going to be talking with the students at in Montreal about the largest student strike in, I guess, certainly Quebec history, ongoing right now, over the battle over tuition. And later in the show, we're going to talk to Thomas Mountain, and listeners will know that we like to go to the mountain. He's in Eritrea, so we're going to find out what's going on in that part of the world. But we are joined now, I believe, by Thomas Martin Sobotky. Are you there, sir?
Yes, I am.
Very nice to talk to you. You've got a great book, Across That Dark River, a great title. And I should tell you, today's Globe and Mail, which is the national paper of Canada, is commemorating that this is the day of the surrender of Robert E. Lee to General Grant. So it gives us a nice context. You have, in the last chapter of your book, a meditation on what people should need to know about the Civil War and should be thinking about, and you start with an American historian, Mr. Horton, who is black, and I think you make an emphasis on that because there is this issue of Civil War tends to be talked about between white people, largely. You focus in the book, but also with Mr. Horton, on the thoughts of those people who had been slaves and on what has flowed from that the experience of the Civil War. You want to talk about that, why you chose to do that?
Yes. You know, the memory of the American Civil War for the American people has been contentious since April 9th, 1865, really the official end of the war some months later. It's been contentious all along. And there has been a great difficulty due to the fact that the United States, quite frankly, has a white supremacist past. Some may argue a little bit of that is lingering now in the Trayvon Martin controversy and how some people may view President Obama as the first black president. What James Oliver Horton did in 2001, he talked to the National Park Service of the United States, and they were gathered at Gettysburg, and they were trying to come to a more 21st century version of how do we in various parks portray the meaning of the American Civil War. And my area of study, particularly on the subject, is what's called memory studies, which is how we remember and how we commemorate the American Civil War. And, of course, that itself recognizes that there's some contention here. If it was all settled, there really isn't much for me to worry about how we remember it. We'd all know that. But what Professor Horton did was talk about his experience as a black man and how he wanted the Park Service to switch its portrayals of the war much more to an African-American perspective, not entirely, of course, mm-hmm. but to recognize the place of slavery, white supremacy. He talked about lynching. He looked at some photos of lynchings in the South and noted to the group quite amazingly in his speech that that he had looked at these photos, particularly of how white people were looking at lynchings after the war, and recognized that race was involved in all of this. And he said there was a pathology there, mm-hmm. a pathology shaped over generations as a significant aspect of American culture. Mm-hmm. And I think he hit that dead on. Yes. When I read that, I'd heard about the speech. It's one of those things that if you're in the field, you kind of know about it, and I'd actually, when I wrote the book, I wanted to go take a look at it. And when I looked at that, he uses the word pathology. That It's one thing to be so gutsy and come up and tell mostly white park rangers that you're going to have to talk about slavery and race and not just about states' rights. And now here we're talking about a pathology that Americans have. That's an illness. That's a sickness, isn't it? A disease of some sort.
Well, you know, that's very apropos of something. We had the American poet and very celebrated one, Ishmael Reed, a black novelist and poet, lives in the West Coast, U.S., and he says, you have to understand that racism is a mental illness, and that should be the starting point.
Well, that's right. And, you know, Professor Horton is Professor Emeritus, and I think he's part-time now at George Washington University, and a distinguished scholar, and it took great courage to say that, but it's something African-Americans know instinctively. They don't have to be told, but I'm a white American, but someone who... if you've read my book, which you have, you know, has very untypical reactions to these things since childhood. And I, of course, am in my 50s, so I lived through as a young teen the height of our civil rights movement of the 20th century. And I just felt that there has to be a recognition that race and slavery were central to the entire American Civil War, and that we can't understand really much of American history without understanding and recognizing that first. And there is a significant body of Americans who just refuse to accept this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, by the way, the book is very apropos. To remind our listeners, the title of this book is Across That Dark River, and the author is Thomas Martin Sabatke, and it's Moving Train Books. And, of course, in the day of Internet, you can all access it real quick, and you should. When we read today's headlines, your book, I was glad to have it right in my hands, because we have this news from Tulsa of two white individuals allegedly shot five black Americans. And already today, I'm reading headlines which say, well, these might have been revenge killing, as though this doesn't have anything to, as you know, it eliminates the issue of race. You write about lynching, and you write about mob violence in that part of, I think, some of those incidents. But I know you talk about New Orleans, and I know what happened in Texas, Oklahoma. This one was in Oklahoma.
Yes, I do detail two large.
You must see an echo of what you
race riots in 1866, but they were really the hunting down and shooting of black people. Unarmed,
and they like to use that excuse of or invoke the issue of revenge. I mean, lynching black men, it was because allegedly some white woman was violated, right?
Yeah, or any number of things. In the case of the New Orleans race riot of 1866, it was that many liberal whites and New Orleans blacks had the temerity to simply want to change the constitution of their state to allow at least the most educated blacks to have some participation in Louisiana's government. And a lot of Confederate soldiers back from the war could not stand this, and they went and shot down dozens of people, almost all black, in cold blood on the streets. They hunted them down into the a place where the meeting had been held and shot them down. In Memphis, Tennessee, earlier that year, in the spring of 1866, there were blacks who had mustered out of black regiments that had been stationed there, and they had a lot of money, and they were looking for jobs, and they had the temerity to actually act like they were real citizens, and they didn't get off a wooden sidewalk one evening and look away and, you know, show the proper deference to whites, and whites responded with violence that killed 50 or 60 blacks, some of them women and children in their homes, and they burned churches and schools. And of course, there were commissions to look into it, but there was very little done about it. And so when we look at these things that happen today, of course, they're on a much smaller scale and everything like that. But I've written in my book that today's kind of racism really kind of is in those dark crevices and cracks of the American culture. That pathology is still visible today, but you have to look harder. But it's there, and I think that history does kind of collide with current events now.
Mm-hmm. And again, we're talking to the author, Thomas Martin Sobotka. The title is Across That Dark River. You talk about an episode in American history, a moment in this Civil War, which near the end, which I was unaware of, certainly, and you highlighted and underlined. This is the visit to Savannah, recently captured by Sherman's army, really one of the most dramatic moments bringing the war to an end. But Secretary of War Stanton came to Savannah, and really an important mission. And to talk about that a little bit. This book really highlights that.
It's really an interesting moment. Sherman had made his march to the sea in 1864, and this was early 1865, and he had thousands of people that had followed his armies. These are blacks who had left their plantations and cut themselves loose as the Union Army gave them that opportunity. And, of course, the Savannah community, Savannah, Georgia, black population, both free and slave, were very accomplished people, whether they were working as slaves or not. And part of what brought Stanton there was to say, are these people really people almost? It's almost as if they're skeptical that, can these people govern themselves? Can they be a part of the American polity when the war is over? Can we even trust them to have land, to marry each other, and so on, engage in labor contracts and all that? Mm-hmm. And the black people chose one gentleman to speak for them, and of course, they, if you look at the questions, and we have this in, you know, any good documentary history, that a couple of things I cite in my book, where you can actually read the questions and answers in full, and you do get a sense of skepticism that, you know, can you people recognize who is in the right and in the wrong? Of course, it's the Union. We're fighting for
also,
the Union. We're loyal.
They wanted to know if they understood what the war was about.
Yeah, and then they had to tell them.
What a great exchange.
And what do you want? You know, what do you people want? What do we have to give you? And, of course, their demands were really very modest at that time. They simply wanted land. They wanted to be able to marry each other. They wanted to be able to earn their own keep. And, frankly, at one point, Mr. Frazier, who was speaking for the group, said, we really want to be left alone. Yes. We don't want whites bothering us. We want to be able to enjoy those basic liberties and freedoms that human beings take for granted so much that black people in Savannah had yet to enjoy. And, of course, this led to Sherman's famous Order Number 15, which settled a lot of these people on the Sea Islands in the Carolinas for a time, for a year or more, as an experiment. And, of course, later that would be countermanded by the U.S. government under Andrew Johnson after Lincoln's assassination.
That was the phrase that it turned into the phrase, popular phrase, 40 acres and a mule, right?
That's right. That was the order that suggested maybe they might have 40 acres and a mule. There was no official decision to offer that across the South. There were very liberal, progressive whites and blacks in the North and some who were coming free in the South who were saying that some sort of settlement of land for all of what they were calling these people the freedmen, who were those who were freed as the war went on.
I like that term myself.
I do too.
I wish I had that.
It gets right to the point and reminds you that these are people and they're now asserting their humanity.
Yeah.
And but I do recommend anyone who reads my book to look and read these very quiet questions and very beautiful answers. They're not especially eloquent in the sense of great rhetoric, but they are clear and sharp.
Yes.
And it is clear to anyone that Mr. Frazier, in speaking for the group and for the citizens of Savannah, the black citizens, was really right on. I mean, he was making a very good case. And to me, just as an American, it's something that really got me emotionally. And it's been pointed out by other historians. It's not unknown in the history profession at all.
Yeah.
But for the American public, I don't think they realize that meeting at Savannah was so important.
Yeah, Mr. Sobotka, I would credit you. I mean, you point out that this needs to be put more centrally into the discussion because you cited at length. Because obviously if that dialogue recorded there had continued, if Mr. Frazier had been called on throughout the ensuing period, a lot of ugliness could have been overcome if it had been established as a principle that there were literate, well-spoken, courageous individuals who could help guide us through this. But we went through instead a very ugly period, as you point out, thanks to the assassination of Abraham Lincoln. I want to point out, by the way, one point he made that I hadn't realized. Mr. Fraser, in response, says, well, we don't mind serving in the Army. As a matter of fact, you know, that'd be fine. However, we do not want to be conscripted in such a way that we replace white people so that we just become sort of the improperly used, you might say. I thought that was a really nice point.
Yes, it was, and it shows you how sophisticated the black community was. Obviously, there were people in Savannah, some of the slaves who had followed Sherman's army, who weren't nearly so eloquent, but of course slavery itself prevents these people from acquiring those skills. It's a degrading institution. But there were plenty of black people who had a folk wisdom, who have expressed themselves in the record. Fraser was a man who had acquired some education, some independence on his own, and had been a minister, and of course was very eloquent. And the group of 15 or so who accompanied him to the meeting also were equally eloquent.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, in a community like that, it's just an extraordinary event. And one can only imagine what both Sherman and Stanton were thinking as they listened to this man, how well-spoken he was. There is some suggestion that they were shocked. And that's kind of pleasing to me as a historian, that it's sort of like, well, this is something they needed to be awakened to. It's unfortunate after the war that so many Southerners really weren't willing to accept black equality, because one of the things that I point out in
you
my
know
book,
why I suspect is because they were equal. They understood, if you listen to Mr. Fraser, you know, they are equal. This is not a matter of an adult and a child.
That's correct. And of course, even in the antebellum period, there, you know, people in the know in the South, most Southerners knew these were human beings, that they had just as much talent, and in every bit as much. And once you free the slave, this is part of the resistance to ending slavery, quite frankly. It's not just economic. Once you free or emancipate the slave, then the question of what kind of rights they are given,
yes,
their equality immediately comes to the forefront, and that is something that white Southerners and, frankly, even a lot of white Northerners weren't prepared for.
Yeah, I think, you know, this is a very important theme. I want to ask you about, because what you just said links to, of course, the most famous phrase we know from Abraham Lincoln, I believe, which is that from the Gettysburg Address about. The battle was about all men being created equal, and their country was going to be tested about whether or not it believed that. I wonder if you could mention, link those two things, Mr. President Lincoln's remarks, which became the, I guess, the template, and then your, I believe you conclude in the book, your feeling that the Gettysburg battle was the most important battle of all.
Well, it certainly was, in that it helped Lincoln, when he spoke in November of 1863, redefine this war. It wasn't just his proclamation and what slaves themselves were doing actively to gain their own freedom once they knew this direction was being taken. And I think when we look at this whole question, the fundamental founding principle of the United States of America in its Declaration of Independence is that all men are created equal. They're endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Your listeners, as well as any listeners around the world, really, via the Internet, will have heard those words and know them well.
Mm-hmm.
Lincoln thought that was the key to what America was. And so in his Gettysburg Address, he was well aware that this war, if won by the Union, would bring about a revolution in race relations. It would force that question. Emancipation was a revolution, just freeing these people.
Yes.
That alone, much less making them equal. That was the next question that he was wrestling with at the time of his assassination, whether he would have acted in a way we would find acceptable today is doubtful because that's 150 years ago. But he was undergoing a real change in his views at the time of his death. I think most even black historians will say that, as well as white historians in the United States and around the world. But that's a fundamental principle, and it is being tested. But in all of American history, I assert in my book that that is what's being tested. Do we really mean equality for not just African Americans, but for women in our history? Do we mean the same thing for working people, for immigrants who may be different somehow than the current population? You can see how this applies to where we are now. So much of American history, I think, as I view it in my book and in the work I do as an historian, is it's this great struggle. And this was a point when the United States and the Civil War had to decide, do we really believe what Jefferson wrote in 1776 or not? Is that really the animating fundamental moral principle the nation is founded upon?
Is it true? Isn't it a fact, I guess is the way I should put it, that Alexander Stevens, the vice president to Jefferson Davis, said that the Thomas Jefferson's error and the founder's error was to say that all men were created equal?
Yes, he did. And in fact, he angered rather, it's private, but we have records that show that letters and things that show that Jefferson Davis, the president, wanted to appeal to Britain and France to get their support in this fight for states' rights and all of this sort of thing. And he didn't want to air what everyone in the South knew in the new Confederacy. And there goes Alexander Stevens, his new vice president, and he goes down to Savannah, Georgia, that very same place, in 1861, and says the whole point of the Confederacy is that the white man is the superior to the black man, that blacks are inferior. And this whole thing of all men are created equal really just applies to whites. And
we should make sure they don't forget
document.
That, too.
Yeah, it's a really interesting contrast, and I mentioned in my book that a Carolina black congressman during the Reconstruction era, when blacks could serve in Congress for a time from the South, stood on the floor of the House and reminded Mr. Stevens, who had been readmitted as a congressman from his home state of Georgia, of his speech 12 years before and how hypocritical he was. And I would have liked to have been on the floor of the House that day. If I could have that magic as a historian.
Boy, wouldn't we all? Well, listen, by the way, you have a magical way of writing about it. This is Thomas Martin Sobotka. I should probably close on that. I'm calling your book a meditation. It's a unique method of writing history. You want to say a few words about that?
Yes, I will, real quick. Across That Dark River, I got the title because veterans of the Civil War talked about or spoke about their comrades who were camping on the other side of that dark river. And for me, it was a rumination of where do I see our country and what are the requirements that we have as the United States commemorates the sesquicentennial, the 150th anniversary of the entire war. We're right in the middle of it right now. And what should Americans look at? And we've got a 19th century framing of the war that is still rather dominant in a 21st century racially and ethnically more diverse America. And it was my thinking about it, and I did even go to the point of imagining myself at this dark river where I could hear the voices of the principals argue to me and talk to me. I have not heard any voices for real, but it was a literary device.
And well, we're going to claim you channeled them.
Well, these are primary documents that I presented so the public can read what the people of the time had to say both ways and make a judgment and listen to my ruminations. And it's a meditation. I think you've accurately described it.
Yeah. Well, it's a great book. We're very grateful you talked to us. Its title is Across That Dark River. It's Thomas Martin Sobotka, Moving Train Books. Nice title. Nice name for a company. And thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you so much, Bill.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And that, again, is a author of a really interesting, helpful book, and particularly in light of all this ghastly stuff that's going on with the Trayvon Martin matter, which Mr. Zimmerman is still not, hasn't made no appearance as far as I know. He's still hiding.
He's in hiding.
And Mr. Bales. I mean, right. There's something really sick. Yeah. You have foreign policy, you have Sergeant Bales. He's back in the United States. There are 16 dead people in Afghanistan. And already he's get, you know, his lawyers making all the talk shows, framing a nice picture, and telling us he doesn't remember a thing. How about bringing him out and let's ask him if he remembers a thing? You know, I get tired of this. And now we have Zimmerman, same story. They hide the guy, and they put forward a mouthpiece, and they start honeying him up, you know. Bill Cosby made a statement today, but a very good one. He said that wouldn't have happened without the gun, because he said he would have been afraid to walk up to Martin. And he says, you know, police officers in a situation of that kind call for backup. But no, here the guy had a gun. He knew he was not afraid.
You know, with all the spin that they're introducing into this story, the one thing to remember is that when Zimmerman was on his little phone with the police and they said, are you following him? And he said, yes. And they said, we do not need you to do that.
Yeah.
And all he had to do was turn
and
around
and
walk
away. By the way, the
language away.
Showed yeah. they were afraid he's about to do something yeah. stupid.
Yeah.
They were trying to calm him down.
Hmm.
You're listening to the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM, and we are joined on the line by somebody from Montreal, one of the student leaders.
Sissy,
good to talk to you. Thanks very much for joining us. You have the involved in what is clearly the biggest student action that we have ever seen in Canada, frankly. And it's been going on for weeks, and I noticed Noam Chomsky made a statement in support of you. He made a wonderful point. He said, you know, in other parts of the world, in Mexico, it's understood that all citizens have a chance to go to universities and not set. They don't have these tremendous tuitions. And he congratulated
right.
you. What stage are we at in this struggle?
Well, we're in about to enter the third week of economic disruptions after the demonstration, after the large demonstration that we had on March 22nd. So, I mean, students knew that it wasn't going to be over with that. You know, more pressure needed to be put on the government, and the form that has taken is through economic disruption to various Quebec establishments. So, and this happened all across the province. Students have blocked, like, Hydro-Quebec buildings. Bridges have been blocked.
Bridges?
yeah, well, Montreal's an island, and there are only so many ways to get on it, right? So, of course, police has responded in a much stronger manner this time, but also the demonstration, which was huge, it was about 200,000 people, and they went off without any incidents.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there were no arrests. There was, absolutely nothing went wrong, and it was great, but of course, once you start disrupting, putting economic pressure in the economic disruptions,
mm-hmm.
police has been pretty quick to come out and remove students.
Mm-hmm. You, I think when we spoke to you last, I believe you were preparing for this demonstration that we heard was 4 kilometers long or something.
Right.
Just phenomenal.
People bust in from all over Quebec, and Montreal, of course, has a number of universities, so... And most people were on strike in all of those universities. We were on strike for 3 days as the graduate students at McGill, and many undergraduate departments at McGill were on strikes of various lengths that allowed those students to take the day to come out to the demonstration. So, I mean, that played a large role in the large number of people who were able to come out. And, of course, the unions had encouraged their members to come out as well, and people were bringing their parents. And so I think that's how we ended up with 200,000 people in the street.
Yeah, I would think that the parents would want to come and say, yeah, we don't want to pay that tuition.
No, exactly. They know what's coming. I mean, in fact, the high school students were coming out as well. And, yeah.
We're speaking to Sunchi Avlegis, and you're, of course, at McGill, right?
Yes, I'm at McGill.
And now, with this, what kind of response is there? Is this causing any alteration in the posture of the government, or how's it? And how's the media treating you?
The media has been, you know, here and there. They were really, they spoke in favorably to the demonstration because it was peaceful and it was It had so much obvious overwhelming support. Of course, they've been condemning, you know, different media outlets have been condemning some of the economic disruptions. But the government, so far, they have given their first proposal, which was to offer us more loans to help us, to help the students deal with the...
to dig yourself deeper into a problem.
Yeah, yeah, so of course there was...
You will owe your life to the company store, according to a famous song.
Yeah, exactly. So, but I mean, since then, there has been at least one, if not three, demonstrations in Montreal every single day. Since
every single day.
Every single day, and I'm here... in the square next to UCAM University, in fact, all day today, there was physically a public assembly. People have been coming and going. There's balloons. There have been speeches. So, you know, it's a holiday, but it doesn't stop.
Yeah.
It's been basically happening for ever since that demonstration, every single day there has been something.
Phenomenal.
Yeah.
By the way, this there's going to be unfolding of the consequences from this for years, because you're involving 250,000 people in the streets.
Yes,
will change
exactly.
Many lives.
Yes, and so they're really hoping for a better response from the government in the coming weeks.
You could help get a new government, I think.
Well,
maybe you should run some people for parliament, for the National Assembly.
Yeah, I think people have had enough, at least from the support and from all the people who are coming out every single day. So.
Yeah. Well, that's tremendous. Sunchi, thank you very much for that update. We're going to talk to you again, we hope, in the near future. And
I hope to have really good news for you next time we talk.
Yeah, but it's certainly exciting news here every time. Thank you.
Yes, thank you.
Okay.
Bye.
Bye-bye. That's Sunchi Avlegis, and she is at McGill. And soon we're going to be – oh, we're going to – I'll tell you what we're going to do. We're going to take a time out. This is a Taylor Report. You can write to us, Taylor, at CIUT. FM, and we'll be back in a moment.
Don't wait a minute longer. Show your support for the 2012 Spring Membership Drive and help us continue delivering great radio. By showing your support early, you will also be entered in to win an amazing prize pack. From now until midnight on Sunday, April 15th, your donation will qualify you for our early bird draw, filled with various prizes such as Play-to-Record gift certificates, Tiff Bell Lightbox regular screening passes, Rusko concert tickets, and much more. Go to www.ciut.fm to donate now. 25 years and counting, CIUT 89.5 FM from the roots up.
From the roots up, CIUT 89.5 FM, Toronto, presenting the history and evolution of sound for 25 years and counting. CIUT 89.5 FM, Toronto.
We're back. It's the Taylor Report. Just remind you, hey, this is CIUT, and we're celebrating 25 years and growing. And next week, we're going to be fundraising. That would make it 25 years and groaning. Now, we want you to join in, and you can start right now if you want. Just go to CIUT.fm and you can make a donation. And you, did I say donation? A pledge.
A
pledge. And you can you can indicate the program. And I'll remind you, this is a Taylor Report. But to do, you could, as I say, you start now and warm us up for next week. And of course, next week we want to hear from you all, and we hope to raise a lot. By the way, I want to mention we've lost one of our old supporters, a man from Cup W. His name was Lionel Dupuis. He was retired in Quebec City. He was one of the militants at the Toronto local. If you read the Canadian history of the Canadian postal workers by anybody, particularly the militant period of, I guess we're going to say 70s, 80s, one of the strongest guys standing there throughout the battles was Lionel Dupuis. And we're sorry he's gone, and he died April the 5th, and we'll talk more about him in the future. But we are joined now by the man in Eritrea, Thomas C. Mountain. Are you there, Thomas?
Yes, I am.
Hey, thank you very much. You're one of the toughest soldiers we know. You get up and talk to us in the middle of the night in Africa. You have a new article. You've written a number of really important articles on this theme. You have it in for Hollywood, and you particularly have it in for George Clooney, whom you'd identify as either a State Department or CIA, quotes, volunteer spokesman for the Horn of Africa. What is he up to? And it's quite an operation, by the way. Not just him. You mentioned others. if you could talk about him. John Pendergast and this wonderful name that I did not know about, Gail Smith.
Yes, well, we dubbed him George the Looney Pooney. He's certified Holly Weirdo. Mm-hmm. He has a guru named John Pendergast, who is the otherwise known as the CIA's plainclothes man and the Horn of Africa. Mm-hmm. John Pendergast got his start here in East Africa some time back, but he really came on as the protege of one Gail Smith, who is probably one of the least known senior officials in the Barack Obama administration, the allegedly black president in the White House.
Yeah.
Gail Smith, actually, the longtime CIA agent, got his start in the Horn of Africa way back in the 1970s.
And what a story. According to you, by the way, you can get this in Countercurrents, right? The article you wrote.
The article is entitled Gorilla Mistress to Obama Confidant, The Life and Crimes of Gail Smith. And it's Gail, G-A-Y-L-E, Smith.
Mm-hmm.
You can go look it up in the internet, or you could even just Google Gail Smith's name, and you'll see just some basic
Thomas facts. Mountain is one of her favorite authors.
Yeah, well,
is it true that she was the mistress of, if we could just say this flatly, of an Ethiopian gorilla, or was he an Eritrean? What was the story?
She was the mistress of she was originally married to a journalist named Dan Connell, who was claimed to be a friend of Eritrea, but these days has been calling on, saying all kinds of really nasty things about Eritrea. But she dumped Dan Connell and went on to become the mistress of one of the cadres of the Tigrayan People's Liberation Front, the head of which was Meles Zenawi, who was what is now the Prime Minister of Ethiopia.
And they remain close, do they?
Well, they many people feel that Gail Smith is the first one person most responsible for Meles Zenawi being a member of the G20. Now,
he came to Toronto.
The world's great powers.
He came to Toronto.
He came to Toronto.
We couldn't get within 2 miles, but we heard he was here.
That's back in the Tuantanamo days. Yes, he was there. And Ethiopia is the most aid-dependent country in the world. According to the IMF, they needed, back in 2010, they needed $7 billion a year to keep the economy from going belly up. That's more than, Egypt gets what, $1.5 billion? Israel gets something like $4 billion, maybe $4.5 billion. Ethiopia gets more Western aid every year than its two nearest competitors, Egypt and Israel combined. People aren't even aware.
Now that's a serious investment. What are they getting in return?
Well, Western foreign policy American foreign policy is based on, instead of having to do the dirty work yourself, you get a local enforcer, a mafioso, a cop on the beat. In South America, it's Colombia. In West Africa, it's Nigeria. In the Middle East, it's Israel. In East Africa, it's Ethiopia.
A policeman.
Ethiopia is the U.S. enforcer out here. And $7 billion a year keeps the wolves at bay for Meles Zenawi, who is undoubtedly the most hated man in Africa if they held an election for such.
Mm-hmm.
And, Ethiopia's got armed insurgencies in five different parts of the country, in the southeast, in the Ogaden, in the southwest, in Oromia, which actually comprises more than half of Ethiopia's population,
mm-hmm.
in the far west, in Gambela, and even in Tigray, the homeland of the regime, and of course recently in amongst the Afars, who kidnapped some German tourists, which the Ethiopians used as an excuse to attack Eritrea, blaming Eritrea for it.
Mm.
So they got these massive armed insurgencies against the government. You've got millions of people starving in the south of Ethiopia, according to the United Nations Famine Early Warning System, and worst drought in 60 years, with millions of people starving in southern Ethiopia.
Mm-hmm.
Ethiopia has instituted a food and medical aid blockade, the Red Cross and Doctors Without Borders are not allowed, have been expelled and not allowed to work in southern Ethiopia.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this is the real genocide that's going on. And what the George Clooney's role in all this is to get up there and shout murderer and point the finger at Sudan, all the while Ethiopia is actually carrying out the real genocide. Now, I don't know, there's an article I have called Burying the Darfur Genocide Myth, where I went in and I was one of the first Western journalists to write about Darfur back in 2003.
Mm-hmm.
And I've interviewed over a dozen long-term veteran aid workers.
Uh-huh.
Between them, they have over 50 years of on-the-ground experience in Darfur, and not one of them says there was a genocide in the Darfur. They say yes. That.
And as a matter of fact, some of them cautioned against it, didn't they? I mean, some of them even took public stands, I remember.
That's right, and then they've said there's maybe between 20 to 30,000 people died in a tragic conflict that took place in Darfur, most of which happened in the year 2004.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so they go a couple of years later, you've got this Save Darfur movement, which, again, the Enough Project with John Prendergast, protege of Gail Smith. Okay, so
mm-hmm.
now, recently I wrote an article called The U.S. Plan to Destabilize Sudan. Mm-hmm. And this whole recent media offensive that John Prendergast has launched with George Clooney's help, George Clooney being the volunteer spokesperson for the CIA in the Horn of Africa, and he goes along with it. He's volunteer as long as there's first-class airplane tickets and five-star hotel rooms, right?
Well,
and
he also he gets himself involved in intelligence photographs of southern Sudan. He pays for satellites, he uses his name.
Yeah,
he doesn't pay for it.
Yeah, he does pay for it. He and Brad Pitt, Angela Jolie, another one of my favorite Hollywood weirdos.
Angelina Britt, yes.
They set up something called the Satellite Sentinel Project. Well, lo and behold, it's actually part of the Enough Project. Again, comes back to John Prendergast, where during the Sudanese referendum, where they broke away, South Sudan broke away from Sudan last year, George Clooney, Brad Pitt, and these Hollywood weirdos paid over $1 million to buy satellite time where they could take pictures of Sudan during the vote for the referendum for independence to see if there's going to be a massacre or whatever. I mean, every day hundreds of South Sudanese children die from waterborne illnesses or just plain malnutrition. Every day, hundreds. And instead of these are preventable deaths, and instead of spending their $1 million saving the lives of these South Sudanese children, they bought satellite photos to monitor the election.
Yeah.
Weirdo?
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? And the thing is, the Enough Project knows what's going on. They can't say they don't know what's going on in Ethiopia, because back when, Gail Smith is a Clintonite, and she reached one of her apogees of power first as a National Security Council African desk head for Bill Clinton back in the 1990s. Now,
you know, it's a small group of people.
Pardon?
I say it's a small group of people. They move from administration to administration, but they're always there, aren't they?
Susan Smith, Gail Smith, and Susan Rice, Gail Smith, and Anthony Lake, now head of UNICEF, Clinton's National Security Advisor. Now, Gail Smith moved into an opposition position. They go back and forth between open senior directors of the U.S. intelligence community when their boys and their horses in office. And then when they're out of office, they go back into NGOs. Gail Smith took up residence. I think it's called the Center for American Progressive Democracy. And she set up the
Every year they add a new adjective. By the way, this is Thomas Mountain. I got to remind our listeners who's written this new piece about George Clooney, volunteer spokesman for CIA, volunteer spokesman for the Horn of Africa. You know, with the previous article, the one I believe with apropos of Gail Smith, guerrilla mistress to Obama confidant, the life and crimes of Gail Smith, I went to the site and of your article in Cross Currents, and there was a photo with it, and there was George Clooney, Mr. Prendergast, and Kofi Annan.
Yep, Kofi the corrupt, Annan, yes.
Busy people. Yeah. They must take vacations together.
Well, see, they all knew about the genocide in Ogaden because when Gail Smith and John Prendergast were in the opposition to the Bush regime, outside of the regime, at the Enough Project, they actually even wrote some articles back in 2007, 2008, and published them on the websites talking about how the Red Cross and Doctors Without Borders have been expelled from southern Ethiopia, and how this was a potential genocide brewing. And then once Obama started his campaign for presidency and Gail Smith jumped on the Obama for President bandwagon as a senior advisor, boom, everything critical of the U.S. enforcer on the beat in the Horn of Africa disappears. Ethiopia is no longer, they're no longer a genocidal regime. They're outposts of peace and democracy. In any case, everything points the finger at Sudan. Sudan, and the reality is that Darfur, the relief effort for the victims of the Darfur conflict, is rated as the most successful aid effort in history. Mm-hmm. And without the support and leadership of President Omar al-Bashir of Sudan, it would not have been possible. In other words, while President Bashir of Sudan was supposedly carrying out the Darfur genocide, he was also playing a critical role in saving hundreds of thousands of lives of those very same people. Mm-hmm. Now, all the aid workers on the ground I've talked to said, no, there never was a genocide, and they're quite proud of the fact that in spite of how the UN loves to spend billions of dollars in aid relief, and, you know, they carried out a very successful relief effort. So we busted the Darfur genocide myth. That's been buried now. George Clooney helped raise over $100 million. He's one of those Angela Jolie, George Clooney, out there saying, save the Darfur people, save the Darfur children, the starving children. Yeah. The Save Darfur fraudsters raised over $100 million for Darfur relief, and we have not been able to find any of that has been spent in Darfur. Again, in the process of interviewing all these aid workers with over 50 years on the ground in Darfur, I couldn't find a single one of them that ever ran across a penny that came from the Save Darfur effort.
That's quite logical in that since they had demonized the central government, they were unwilling to cooperate with the government, which was, of course, making sure the aid was delivered, made it possible for the aid. So they didn't want to cooperate, so they put it somewhere else.
But well, it's worse than
now
that.
They moved the show to another address, right?
It's even worse than that, though, see, because some of these aid workers were the ones that tipped me off that they've been asking questions themselves. They'd heard about it. They started asking people they knew in the Save Darfur movement, insiders that worked there, hey, how come we're not seeing any of this money? And the response was, it's going to Israel. The pro-Israel people that set up the Save Darfur movement, of which Prendergast is one, diverted at least a substantial portion of the saves, at least several million dollars, to commingled it in accounts that were used to fund humanitarian projects and illegal Israeli settlements on the West Bank. So we've got over $100 million missing dollars that George Clooney helped raise. And now he's turning around and saying, genocide in Sudan, and right next door in Ethiopia, there are real genocides going on. There's no food aid blockade, no medical aid blockade at Darfur, no. A very successful, biggest relief effort in history. In the south of Ethiopia, there's millions of people starving in the worst drought in 60 years, and the Red Cross and Doctors Without Borders is kicked out. Enough Project knows about it. And so what do? To divert attention from the Ethiopian genocide, make sure nothing happens there, they bring in the big guns. They bring in George Clooney, who's a professional at projecting sincerity and honesty, and his face gets out there all over the world saying, genocide in Darfur, murder in Sudan, don't look at Ethiopia. Yeah. That's his role. Yeah. That's why I call him the volunteer spokesperson for the CIA in the Horn of Africa.
Yeah. Seems to me you ought to do that, and you did. And you also called, of course, attention to the fact these guys are all very intimate, some of them, with the how do you pronounce his name? Melis Zenawi, who runs Ethiopia. They're all very comfortable with him.
Well, Angelina Jolie was reported to have had a private meeting with the Prime Minister of Ethiopia, Melis Zenawi, when she went there to buy her baby some years back. Ethiopia is a major home. If you want to buy a baby, it runs about $30,000 a pop. They're selling something like 3,000 babies a year.
Well, we're helping them out one baby at a time.
That's right.
The very least we can do.
like I say to people, don't believe anything you read and almost nothing you see on the Horn of Africa. Everything is upside down. You know, upside down, black is white and right is wrong. It's all completely Hollywood when it comes to the Horn of Africa.
Yeah, and you probably shouldn't go to Hollywood for political advice.
Angelina Jolie's a great advisor. She's a humanitarian coordinator for UN Human Rights Commission. I mean, United Nations Commission for Humanitarian Refugees and Humanitarian Commission for Refugees, and she called on the United States to declare war and start bombing Sudan. So, I mean, you're going to get advice from Hollywood. And the thing is, these guys are actually almost protégés as well as some famous Israeli agents that have been exposed as being big players in Hollywood.
Yeah. Well, you made that they had the ICC, that phony court, finally after 10 years convicted one man, of course an African, and Angelina Jolie was there in the courtroom to make sure that the world noted through her, their spokesperson, that they had convicted this African.
Yeah, the guy from the Congo.
From Congo.
Yep. Luis de Ocampo, the accomplice, is apparently going to retire soon. So they're, but you know, he's demanding Saif Islam's head so that they could try him. But for some reason, I don't think Sarkozy really wants Saif Islam tried in Europe, because I think Sarkozy's worried about a lot of intimate details of the $50 million that he was received in his crucial days of his election campaign that might come out. But you know, there's a lot of things going on out this part of the world that I just want to warn people about. One of the things is this silent children video that's gone viral.
Yes, Mr. Coney.
Millions of viewers. Yes. That's part of the Not Projects work too, it turns out.
They're saying
Lord's Resistance Army.
Evangelical Christians and the Enough Project. Amazing.
Well, you know, they're if you go to the Enough Project's website, you see that they're quietly very supportive and try not to boast too much. You get the fingerprints, this modus operandi of the slick Hollywood-style propaganda campaign about Joseph Kony and the Lord's Resistance Army. Well, guess what? Joseph Kony was a real criminal, but you know what? That was actually took place years ago.
Yes.
And they're talking about South Sudan, Joseph Kony back and forth through northern Uganda, and guess what? That's all old history. He's long gone. He's down to a handful of supporters. He's no longer a threat. The people in North Uganda are pissed off just by the fact that this video it made a big deal out of it. And again, it's a smokescreen to cover up the real criminals in the Horn of Africa, Mela Sinawi and his food aid blockade, what Uganda is doing in Mogadishu, killing tens of thousands of Somalis with indiscriminate heavy artillery bombardment that's flattened something like 30 square miles of Mogadishu, created 500,000 refugees. This is what Uganda's really doing. Instead, they're talking about Joseph Kony. Joseph Kony's a small player, long lost, you know, off in the bush someplace.
They like to pick on people the right size to harm without any danger to themselves.
The smokescreen, you go and you point the finger at something that's not a problem so that everybody focuses their attention there. You cry thief or you cry murder and say, look over there. Don't look at the real murderers, you know? And that's what's going on.
Yeah. Well, thank goodness we have you, Thomas, writing the material. People should just go, just say Thomas Mountain, and you'll get there. A lot of great articles. And
keep your eyes open, ears open, your eyes open for an article coming out called Silent Children and Enough Project, Spying, Lying, and Covering Up the Real Genocide in the Horn of Africa.
We will look for that, Thomas. Thank you very much. Thanks for staying up.
Toronto.
Okay.
Thanks.
Bye-bye. Thomas Mountain. And I know Mr. Mountain has a lot of followers here and admirers. He is a very courageous man. So he would, like us, would say, make sure you support the Taylor Report, the CIUT. You can go to the CIUT site right now. You can make pledge early if you like. Just put the name of the show in. And it's going to be, of course, we begin on April the 16th. We know you're all going to be right there at the starting point and supporting us. Phil, we have some announcements, an important one tomorrow morning.
We do, Phil. It's actually not tomorrow. It's on Thursday morning is the anniversary of a very traumatic event in Toronto's history, and that was the hanging by the British of two Toronto citizens, Samuel Lount and Peter Matthews. Samuel Lount and Peter Matthews were hanged for having rebelled against British rule in 1837 in the rebellion led by William Lyon Mackenzie. The only reason why Mackenzie wasn't hanged with him is that the British couldn't get their hands on him. But they definitely would have hanged him as well.
He came back later and lived here.
He did.
But they hanged these guys.
But they hanged these two guys. I think one was a blacksmith and the other was also a tradesman of some variety. They are Toronto's real heroes, and there is political history in this town, and this is an ugly little moment in Toronto's history. And the place where they hanged is now a park, and there's going to be a rally there. This Thursday morning at 7:30 at the corner of Toronto Street and Court Street. If you don't know where that is, it's a 5-minute walk from the King subway station just off of Church Street.
Just up from the King Eddie Hotel.
That's right.
Used to be.
They changed the name of it. So please go to the website Lount and Matthews or send an email to lountandmatthews@gmail.com. Let them know you're coming. You're going to get a T-shirt commemorating Lount and Matthews if you come this Thursday, 7:30 in the morning, to the commemoration.
The reason they're setting that hour is that's when they were hanged.
That's when they were hanged. And
10,000 people.
That is the spot where they were hanged. You're going to be there to commemorate something that happened right there on that spot at 7:30 on April the 12th, 1838.
Yeah. Yeah, that was a grim moment. When Charles Dickens visited the city, he found a woman in jail here, and he said it was one of the most striking women he ever saw in his life because she was so fierce. He said he was looking at her, she was looking back, and he said he was told that she was a courier for the rebels of 1837. But I would tell our listeners, you should be interested to know that Fidel Castro has written a little piece. It's published in Counterpunch today. Counterpunch, just go on the internet, talking about Mr. Harper and Canada and his appreciation of brave Canadians who stood by his country, have not followed the Americans in the demonization. And he said, but some still suffer from that American disease. He wonders, you know, he wants Canada to be Canada. It's a very nice, very eloquent article. Fidel's getting more eloquent in his old age. So that's Counterpoints today, and we want to correct something. We often do this. We like to correct people. Toronto Star has a headline today: Pope calls on the Syrian regime to end bloodshed. Monday, the April 9th, Toronto Star. Not true. Not true. He did not call on the Syrian regime. He said we want peace in Syria, and we hope they will live up to the agreements, and by that he implies all parties. He did not single out one side. The Toronto Star is desperate to get everybody against the government of Syria, so they put in the word regime. That's not helpful. That is not what the Pope said. By the way, the Pope says stop the damned embargo against Cuba, too. And the Pope said don't attack Iraq. And the Pope said don't invade Afghanistan. What? I don't remember them putting that in their papers. You know, it's not fair. This is a major figure in the world. We all understand that. The Pope's, if he says something, just tell us what he said. Don't add the word calls on the Syrian regime. He'd like to see an end to the bloodshed in Syria, but he didn't signal out anybody because he's serious. This is just propaganda writing, and it ain't helpful. So I guess we covered more than I thought we did. We're getting near the end. This is the Taylor Report. You can write to us, taylor@ciut.fm. You can check our programming out on the web at taylor-report.com. I think I've already mentioned that there's a lot of important stuff going on, and our site reflects it all. We do want to say this. Gunter Grass wrote a great poem. There's nothing wrong with the poem. He doesn't have anything to apologize. If he says that the two powers that are presently debating about hitting each other over the issue of nuclear weapons, he said, put that under international supervision so that neither one does that. And he says, no preemptive wars. That's very helpful. There's been a weird reaction to him because he's a Nobel Prize guy, but That was a helpful poem. I urge you, just go on the net, read the poem, ignore all the propaganda around it. This is Phil Taylor for Phil Conlon and Carol for the Taylor Report. We hope you're with us next week and help us raise funds. You can start right now. Go to the CIUT website.